Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we may be with literally one of the best guitar players in the world today, or in his niche for sure. I'm with Brian Sutton. He's certainly the most accomplished and awarded acoustic guitarist of this generation anyway. He's successfully taken the bluegrass flat picking traditions of the 20th century and fused it with dynamic roots music scene of the 21st. He's a band leader, record producer, mentor, educator, and leader in online music instruction. Brian's from Asheville, North Carolina, which is obviously an area rich in bluegrass and mountain music. His dad and his grandfather both played together in a band, and Brian picked up the guitar at age 8. He studied some jazz guitar and was planning on going to Berkeley, but his plans were set aside when he got invited to start doing some work as a sideman. He relocated to Nashville in 1994 to play sessions, and over a year and a half doing that, he built his resume and relationships. He then formed a friendship with bass player Mark Fain, and that led to the job that would really put him in the limelight, and that was playing guitar for artist and musician Ricky Skaggs, right when Ricky was changing up his band from country to bluegrass, which was Ricky Skaggs and the Kentucky Thunder, obviously one of the top bands of the 90s and the resurgence of bluegrass music. And even though that band had three guitarists, Brian's lead playing stood out. If you know him and you know his playing, then this is, you know, self-evident. If you're not, I really encourage you to check Brian out online. He's a tremendous player. After about 3 years working with Ricky, Brian started a family and refocused on Nashville studio work, where he rather quickly became the most called upon acoustic guitarist in town. Today, his discography reads like a roll call of Nashville's last two decades, with credits on albums by people like Garth Brooks, Taylor Swift, Blake Shelton, Eric Church, Brad Paisley, Carrie Underwood, and many more. Trust me, I trimmed this list dramatically. He also played a major role in recording projects in modern-day bluegrass and acoustic music like Dolly Parton's Grammy-winning The Grass is Blue, Dierks Bentley's Up on the Ridge, Charlie Hayden's Rambling Boy, and the Dixie Chicks' groundbreaking Home album. During these years, he also supported numerous recordings by leading traditional Americana artists like the Chieftains, Patti Loveless, Rhonda Vincent, Mindy Smith, Jim Lauderdale, Adam Steffi, and Dalian Vincent. He was also called in by Bela Fleck at the last minute to tour on the Tales from the Acoustic Planet album. Brian was called in to replace Tony Rice, who was injured. That's some pretty big shoes. Starting just before 2000, Brian kicked off his career as a solo recording artist, and with his own band, he's released 6 solo albums to date. Brian's take on Whiskey Before Breakfast from his 2006 album called Not Too Far from the Tree won the Grammy Award of 2007 for Best Country Instrumental Performance. In 2012, Brian was asked to join the amazing bluegrass quartet Hot Rise, and in 2015, Hot Rise was nominated for 2 IBMA awards, including Album and Entertainers of the Year. That's International Bluegrass Music Association. He's also produced several artists, notably the upstart all-female bluegrass band from Boston, Della May. That sounds like a contradiction, the female bluegrass band from Boston. And he's
times they are a change.
Yeah, man. Now you get one from New York, then you've arrived, I'll tell you. And he's, although I know, what's his name is up there? Grant Gordy. Yeah. Brian's also become the guitar instructor at the innovative artistworks.com video exchange. He's the primary or the only bluegrass guy there. So if you want to learn bluegrass, that's where to go. Brian also not only does lessons, but he receives and critiques videos from students, engaging them individually from all over the world. Now, check this out. I had to like look this up and verify it, not verify it, but look it up twice on two different places. I was just astounded. Brian's won the International Bluegrass Music Award for Guitar Player of the Year 10 times since 2000. And if you really want to see what a class act he is, go look up on YouTube Brian's 2015. It's the 2015 IBMA acceptance speech. And Brian spells his name B-R-Y-A-N Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N. If you don't know Brian, good place to go is go to YouTube and start with the song Logjam. And you'll be taking a deep dive down a rabbit hole. Man, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Craig. Thanks for having me. Appreciate you doing all that research and reading all that stuff. It's good to be reminded of that kind of stuff at least every other day.
man, so you were going to attend Berkeley And then you got called to do session work. What job did you get called for, and how did they know about you, or how did they make the connection?
Well, you know, the sort of long talk part of that story is I grew up around Asheville, North Carolina, like you say, and even though I was playing with my family in the community there, playing old time and bluegrass music, there's a pretty and still a very active scene as far as the professional side of like gospel music. And so there was some pretty active recording studios around there and great musicians as well. Anyway, one of the main piano players that toured with one of the main gospel groups of the day was my next door neighbor. So my mother had the idea when I was a junior, sort of the summer between my junior and senior year, she said, go talk to Anthony about maybe hanging out at the studio. And so that's pretty much what I did. And then that led to just literally, again, being a fly on the wall pretty much every day after school, my senior year, the fall of my senior year, I would go hang out at the studio. And just really taken by that whole scene and realized that, yeah, this is really where I want to be. So anyway, kind of catching up other stuff, I was studying a lot of jazz guitar. And of course, that point in my life, looking at what was going to be post high school for me, and had some other offers from, or not offers, but other options with other just general kind of college things. And also with Asheville, there was a great jazz and recording program there already. In the North Carolina state school system, each school kind of had a forte in a certain sort of musical focus, either, you know, choral or band or church music. And Asheville was recording a jazz. Bob Moog was on the staff. I mean, it was an amazing place. Anyway, the point is that, so yeah, I'm looking at maybe going to Berkeley because I've been playing some jazz and doing a lot of rock while a teenager. And, but this time in the studio, I got to meet all these people, and it sort of hit me that if I could focus on this, and then I got this call to play on, this was the winter break, basically, of my senior year of high school, got called to play on a bluegrass gospel sort of, you know, variety kind of project, a bunch of different singers, a bunch of different songs. And it just like, okay, this I've totally bit hard. And I felt like if I could get this going, I'm getting work now that if I went to college and spent 4 years, it's the kind of work that I'd want to be doing. So why put it off?
Mm.
And that was the crux of it. And, you know, already sort of accepted at the, well, I was going to go to the University of North Carolina at Asheville for a couple of years. And so I had to go back to those guys and say, hey, I'd rather not do this and sort of put up with a little bit of, I don't know what you call it, scorn or a little bit of ridicule about, hey, why aren't you going to college? You really need to do this. You need to go to Berkeley after a couple of years here. And I said, no, man, this is, I see my path and I'm on it. And, so anyway, but that was the crux of it, is basically realizing that I had the opportunity to do work that I wanted to get either now or 4 years from now. So, hey, let's go now.
Man, that's fantastic. Did you, it's funny when you said I had to put up a little bit of ridicule, like if you call them up now and said, hey, I hope you understand why, I made this decision. I mean, that was, yeah. who would be ridiculed, you know?
Right, yeah.
You know, I think that's a pretty, from my perspective anyway, as a 17 or 18 year old kid making that decision, that's a pretty mature decision and thought process to make. Were you always like, that had that sort of level of presence or awareness, or like
that's a good question. I mean, I think the reality is that I came up in a time where a guy like me could see a niche for myself in the music business pretty early on. And especially going to the studios and hanging out and seeing that, you know, sort of actual physical place for that, it really helped. But yeah, I mean, I think back in all these little career questionnaire things that you fill out in high school. I mean, that if it did anything for me, it got my mind thinking about what I did want to do. And I didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but I knew that I wanted to make a living playing music. And there was really never a plan B. My mother always used to say, like, you ought to have something else, you know, to back up in case none of that works. And I don't know. I just never gave that the time. It's like there will never be anything else that I want to do other than play music.
That's really cool. I just think that was really mature. You have kids? You have kids, right?
I have two daughters and one going to college in the fall.
Yeah. So, you know, that age is like to have that presence of mind. That's you know, I really give you credit for that. I certainly didn't have that presence of mind at that age.
Right. And I give my parents total credit too, because my daughter is the same age that I was when I was gallivanting around the country and driving, you know, all hours of the morning and night from a bus in Georgia to try to get to school by 8 a.m. You know, it's crazy.
So how long were you in Nashville before you wound up connecting with Ricky Skaggs? And if you can remember, you know, think about it if you need to, what were some of the early thoughts going through your mind when you first get this gig? Because you're early in your career still, and still a kid.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, still continuing this sort of really trying to make solid decisions about things. I'd been on the road enough to that point, which was sort of 94-ish, maybe even a little earlier than that, as far as touring with a band based out of there and kind of living there a little bit. But knew that the session thing was for me, because again, this was when I started doing those sessions. This is the, now the winter of 1991. And so we're 4 years into this. And, not that I had this huge resume building, but I had consistent work. Again, it was good. It was a lot of driving, a lot of studios around Western North Carolina, East Tennessee, Upper Georgia, upstate South Carolina, this whole sort of network. This is also the time when like ADATs and a lot of these home studios were popping up, and it was easy to do, once I got into that little network. So anyway, I had this sort of mindset, okay, I'm going to go to Nashville and try to reduce this amount of travel, try not to tour with an act, you know, but, you know, and then here comes this call from Ricky Skaggs, and the specific thought, and I do remember this and I'll never forget it, is I remember telling myself, I don't want to travel with anybody, but I'll never know what to do if Ricky Skaggs calls.
Be careful what you wish for, right?
I know. And it was great. It was, like you mentioned Mark Fain earlier, it was a connection through that. And also knowing that Ricky was starting to do a little more bluegrass, that was really enticing to me, because I'd sort of not been in bluegrass for that sort of early 90s part of my life was really about being a utility player and learning to play more fiddle and banjo and dobro and all this other stuff, that I could go in and sort of be the one call guy on a session and do it all. And so having the opportunity to focus back on the guitar seemed like a really good thing for me to do, as far as balancing it all out. So yeah, that was the thing. And I started with Ricky officially in the summer of 1995.
Did Ricky actually make the call to you? Did you pick up the phone, Brian? Hey, this is Ricky Skaggs.
Yeah.
What's going through your head like at that second, if you can remember?
Well, I knew again through talking with Mark that he had sort of thrown my name in the hat. The guy that I had replaced had left somewhat suddenly. You know, usually in the music business, there's a sort of 2-week notice, and I think it was barely that. Mm. And, you know, it's in the middle of the summer and Ricky had a full touring schedule, so he needed somebody quickly. And so, you know, it all happened pretty quickly from the time that I knew that Mark had talked to Ricky about me, and then here comes the phone call. So I was sort of expecting it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not that I was going to get the job, but I was going to get a call from him to go hang out and try out and all this kind of stuff. So,
sure.
So he made the initial call and I picked up and said, yeah. And then we met at his house, maybe a day or two later, and ran over some stuff and sang a little bit and played a little bit. And I was on the bus within a few days of that.
Was it a little intimidating when you first played or not really?
It was intimidating. I mean, again, to that earlier point of making somewhat of a decision to not pursue any kind of road work unless somebody like that called. Ricky was one of these guys that was, again, growing up in an era in acoustic music and bluegrass and country music where there was a lot of crosstalk between players like Jerry Douglas and singers like Randy Travis, and hearing Jerry on these records and hearing Ricky get all these great players, Mark O'Connor, Brent Mason, Jerry Douglas, on his records, on these live, on what was on the radio, what I was hearing on a daily basis. And I was putting all that together and just seeing him as a real sort of central figure in the kind of music that I wanted to play and the level that I wanted to play at, and just loving everything that he'd ever put out from his early days as a bluegrasser. And so anyway, just, I held him in way high regard. And so to be able to sit with him and play, it's weird. You know, it's like anytime you meet a hero, but you've got to sort of just settle down and say, okay, let's do some work.
Yeah, very cool. And for you millennials out there, a radio is something that used to sit on your desk or shelf, and it was like a little music box, kind of like magic. Tune it into certain kinds of music. Okay, so let's take a step back now to some of the session work and the Sideman stuff you've done. I'm going to throw out a few names. If you could talk about how you got the gig with these folks and maybe a cool or interesting story about working with them. Brad Paisley.
That's cool. You know, in the Nashville session scene, you once you sort of get into the stream of it, it's sort of like high school where you've got people that are your age and your class, and you kind of move up the rank together. I came to know Brad through his producer, Frank Rogers, who started his career. And all these guys came out of Belmont. I didn't go to Belmont, but they were graduating from Belmont around the same time I moved to Nashville. So the point is that Frank had a job as a writer and sort of song plugger through EMI. And then also, I think he and Brad sort of cooked up this idea to present Brad as an artist and Frank would produce. Anyway, point is just making those connections through Frank. Brad's a great guitar player, and Brad played most of the guitar on most of his records early on. And then there was just things would come up like, let's go cut a Christmas record for a couple of days. And Brad would say, yeah, I don't feel like playing on it. And so Frank said, well, I got this guy, Brian, over here. And so I think that was the first full record I played on with Brad. And, you know, the way the Nashville session scene works also is it's a real community. And again, once you're in the stream, not to say that it's easy, but part of your job is to just sort of stay in that stream and be consistent and show up. And so, you know, try to be the first in somebody's consciousness. And so that, you know, just being around Brad led to a couple other things. And it's mainly been sort of overdubs and, you know, stuff that he didn't feel like he wanted to play or, you know, just sort of picking up some slack acoustically on the record.
That's pretty cool when you can just say, hey, I don't feel like playing. Just bring Brian Sutton. That's a good deal.
Yeah, well, good for me.
Yeah, man, good for everybody. You know, it's fantastic. Blake Shelton.
That, you know, another cool connection there is a great longtime, hopefully Hall of Fame musician, session player, Brent Rowan. I met him, and this, again, you sort of, if you start peeling back the layers of my existence in Nashville, you're just going to see all kinds of help and connections. But through the Ricky Skaggs thing, I played on some episodes of the Ricky Skaggs Live at the Ryman show that was on the Nashville network back in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And Brent was sort of the house guitarist in that live band. And so I got to know Brent from Ricky inviting me to the house band on a couple occasions. And that led to just Brent recommending me for other sessions. And so there's this new artist named Blake Shelton that Bobby Braddock is producing. Bobby Braddock, great Nashville songwriter and producer. And so Brent played on all these records. And so that was the connection there of just early, again, just the way, same way with Brad early on in his career, making a connection, Blake early on in his career, making the connection. And so, you know, the energy, the way it flows is I was sort of on my way up as a session player as these artists are new and on their way up too. And a lot of times that's where as a new session player, you're going to get a good call with a lot of potential payoff is a new artist. And that, you know, as it is with Blake, I've played on, I think, every record he's done since then. And this is probably maybe around either late 90s, early 2000s for all that.
Very cool. Yeah, I will say that I've probably interviewed 50 session players, and it's one of the nicest communities of people I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. I mean, just, I can't speak highly enough of Nashville in general, but specifically the session guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, there's a lot of Darwinism, I think, that goes on there too, as far as not about strength and things like that, but just an ability to
I like that Darwinism.
Well, you know what I mean. It's like
yeah.
A lot of the people that don't need to be there or don't stick around for whatever reason. You know, the universe sort of takes care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's left is this community of people that want to be there, that can show up and do the gig. You know, so it's not, I don't think by chance so much.
No, it's not. I mean, it's a self weeding out sort of process, you know, and, but everybody that seems to be there is not only a great player, but they're also very good people in general. You know, they're open to, they're a supportive community, I guess is the best way to say it.
Yeah. And also would say, I mean, as far as the, you know, having the ability or the opportunity to be on a lot of sort of big records and, you know, high profile sort of things, a lot of us, you know, we don't take it for granted either. You get that sort of humility class too, of it's like, wow, this is really cool that we're here and let's just enjoy it while we got it.
Yes, 100%. Everybody there is extremely humble. Bela Fleck, I should say, last one.
Right. Well, again, another connection through Ricky. Literally the first weekend I ever played with Ricky was mid-July of 1995. We played a gig in my hometown, Asheville, which was crazy. But the next gig was at Wolf Trap in Virginia, and it was one of these Ricky Skaggs picking parties that he was doing every year in that era. And Bela was one of the guests on that. And so that was an opportunity to play with him and meet him. And through, you know, you think the session world is kind of nice, tight community. Bluegrass is even more of that, probably. So again, once you're, the hard part is sort of breaking in. And once I found that I was in that stream, then it was people like Bela, people like Jerry Douglas, Sam Bush, Tim O'Brien. I was now around them hanging out, you know, thankfully through the auspices of Ricky Skaggs and having this high profile gig, but also being able to hang out with these people and play music.
How cool is that? So one day you're in a session, you're a young kid, next week your first gig with Ricky in your hometown, and then you're playing with Bela Fleck next gig. That had to be like, you know, pinch me kind of a thing.
Yeah, it was a great time. I mean, again, I kind of go back to things that I was fortunate to be in the right place, right time kind of area of Ricky going back to bluegrass, and I was the guitar player in the band. You know, fast forward 3 or 4 years where Jerry Douglas is starting to do more solo work. Bela is starting to kind of return to do a little more acoustic music after doing a lot of, you know, a generation or so with the Flecktones. And you mentioned the Acoustic Planet thing. Tony Rice was obviously the first call, top of the heap guy that those dudes are always going to call, but he was starting to experience some injury and dealing with some of the stuff that has continued to, unfortunately, you know, prevent him from playing more. So I was able to sort of assume some of that he couldn't do, but also get to know him as well and be his pal and record with him and hang out and play live. And it was just an amazing time for me as far as being able to be around the heroes. I try to, you know, equate it to, if I don't know, sports or other, you know, if I was a jazz player back in the 50s and just coming up and being able to just, I'd spent my childhood listening to these greats, and then suddenly I'm with them. You can't do that in classical music. And you know, to be able to go hang out with Bach or Beethoven or any of these guys, that's what it felt like.
I mean, yeah.
These are the dudes that I listened to on a daily basis, and I knew everything about them musically. And so, you know, it was nothing but opportunity.
That's great, man. And you've assumed the mantle and put the work in. So, you know, it's no wonder why it's kept going. You know, doing the same thing over and over again is often boring, but I would imagine getting the IBMA award for Guitar Player of the Year 10 times is not one of those boring things.
No. I mean, my truthful statement, and you hear people say this a lot, is the whole, it's an honor to be nominated. And that really is a true thing for me. Is I, you know, my, also, I guess, you know, back to that sort of thing I said about the session player and maybe the humility, or the also not wanting to look at a career as kind of a spike where you're here today and gone tomorrow. The thing that I'm most proud of all that is not the wins, but 18 years of being, or whatever, 18 years of being nominated, and just being in the conversation as far as what's going on in bluegrass or what's going on in Nashville. I've looked to try to sustain something or to, you know, to work for more longevity than I have all these spikes and things like this. So I hope that makes sense. But that's,
yes, it does.
That's what it feels like to me, is it, or that's the thing that I hold, I'm most proud of, because it's, you know, I have those trophies on my, you know, little bookshelf in my living room, and it's, I'm so proud of every one of them, but I'm most proud of just being around for a while and a long, you know, most of the 2000s at this point. That's what I'm most proud of.
I totally get that.
Being consistent.
Yeah, being relevant, you know, that you've been relevant for that long, that is a major thing to be proud of. I totally understand that. The wins are nice, but that you're in the conversation for that long at that level for that time, that's really, you know, because that's more of a testament to your what you do every day when you get up in the morning and the work ethic that you have more than anything else. And I think that's something that, you know, you have a right to be proud of. Anybody does.
Yeah, that's you know, that there will always be, and there, you know, there's gigs that I don't look forward to do. I get off stage and I go, this is nuts. I shouldn't have done this. I played poorly, or sessions that are just like, why did I do this? But I will never say that I'm doing something that I don't love.
And sure.
Again, just even in the big picture, the huge big picture, to be able to just say that I play music for a living is such a cool thing.
I mean, but statistically, no matter what you do, any profession, in music, out of business, you know, when you do something so many times, you're going to get duds. It's just the numbers reality of life.
Yeah, right. It's the Major League Baseball.
100%.
Yeah.
100%, man. You've been involved in like so many projects. Is it possible if I asked you to say what would be your top three musical experiences, either because of the work you did or the richness of the experience or just the personalities involved?
Wow. What I will say about that, it's tough. I mean, again, I'm the most fortunate guy in the world. And I think, like, to sort of galvanize it into a thing, you know, like the Telluride Bluegrass Festival is an annual thing, but it as an entity in my life and experience playing music, my experience throughout the years at Telluride at a festival, off stage and on stage, has, I just look at moments that have happened there as like this moved me forward. It was one, you know, sort of a catalyst for some other things. So anyway, just for what it's worth, that
Telluride Bluegrass Festival.
Yeah, which is happening next week as far as our interview now.
Oh, that's cool.
Third weekend in June.
What a great – it's in Colorado, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, what a good time to be in Colorado, good time of the year.
Yeah. The other thing, you know, making my duets record, that Not Too Far From the Tree, was a really cool thing just because it – again, what I've tried to do with, like, being around my heroes is not – I mean, still hold them up, still honor them, but also understand that I have to, you know, I got to work with them. I want to be their pal. I got to sort of strip away some of this starstruckness and get to the root of the matter and play some music. And dealing with some of that helped me through that process of, like, is it okay to just call up Doc Watson and say, hey, you want to record something? I'd sort of known him a little bit before that, so there was a little bit of a you know, relationship there, but not much. But I knew that he was, you know, going to be a big anchor for that project. And so just the whole putting that together was great. My sort of methodology in producing that or recording that was, I had this little mobile rig, and I would drive around to people's houses. So I drove to Earl Scruggs' house, Jared Douglas's house. Tony Rice had too many dogs, so we met at a studio. and I couldn't get with Doc, so we recorded that tune. The tune that won the Grammy was recorded in a hotel room in Longmont, Colorado.
Dude, that is such a cool story. That's great.
Old-timey.
That's very cool.
But like one of the best experiences of that project, there was a particular day where I was at my parents' house in Asheville, and I got up with my dad, and we drove to George Shuffler's house in Valdez, North Carolina, and then down to Jack Lawrence's house around Charlotte, and then back to Mom and Dad's house just west of Asheville, and recorded three songs that day in those three places. And that was such a cool thing. And to do it with my dad, that made it great.
That is right. It's really nice, man. Well, one of the, you know, I want to get to the third one, but you know, you mentioned about, so like I could see how developmentally, personal growth wise, this was good for you to go and approach all these guys, you know? Mm-hmm. And the reality is, you know, are they going to say yes? Or are they going to say no? Who knows? But 100% sure, if you don't approach them, you're not going to get the recording done, right?
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
What's the downside, man? It's only up.
Yeah, and it was a little tricky with Doc, just because, doing it in a hotel room wasn't the optimum.
it wasn't set up acoustically for a recording.
Yeah, and so we just had to adapt and make it work, and that, you know, was some fun in that, some sneakiness and all this kind of stuff. So, but anyway, but as far as the third one, it's hard to say. I mean, again, like with the Telluride experience and just years of cool things happening there, I would say the experience that I've had as a session player playing with legendary people from like Porter Wagoner and Eddie Arnold, Johnny Mathis, and just hearing those voices in the headphones and knowing that I'm part of what's happening right now, with that voice, Dolly Parton, George Strait. I mean, there are singers that I've been able to play with over the years that just, to me, do this thing that a lot of other session players would talk about. I know, because we've talked about it for years. It's just, there's a certain ownership of the song just by that person singing it. And your job as a session player is just to sort of get out of the way and be part of that scene. And I love that. I love that sort of disappearing into that sound with that particular artist, that particular singer. Over the years, and then to the more specific point of that, just as a meaningful thing, when I've been on various sessions, and a lot of times this is like after you've tracked for the whole day or maybe two or three days, where the producer says, okay, I got one more song that I just want to do with vocal and acoustic guitar, and that is me in the Briar Patch. Just to be able to sort of orchestrate a song with a single singer, especially when it's somebody of that caliber, has been one of the, maybe the best or most memorable, things that I've done in the studio.
Because of the musical intimacy.
The song and a great vocalist and my opportunity to just support that as a single sound.
Yeah, that's very cool. Hey, what are you working on now that you're most excited about?
We're at a point in my career with sessions in Nashville in general where I don't know that I'm out to pasture yet, but there's certainly moves that I've made in the last several years to tour a little more under my own steam. I'm making solo records now that feature me a little more as a singer and songwriter, less of just, okay, here's my filter of bluegrass guitar and some songs you've already heard. And, you know, trying to put more legitimate energy into that with playing live and do things more that sort of feature that. And the Hot Rise Band as well has been, we put some more new music out in the last several years. It's involved some touring. So I've admittedly removed myself a little bit from the Nashville session scene, but the bottom line is that I'm doing less of that these days. Shingle's still out, but, you know, I see less of what I have in cartage these days than I used to.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I'm continually sort of finding things out about, you know, being more of a songwriter, you know, more sort of general project based kind of thinking versus just, okay, here's a gig next week. There's this other gig. And then a week after that, there's another gig. And so more of a general stream of things. And along also with that is something that's, I really love. And it's turned into more of like what could be considered a real job, is the artist works teaching, where it's a week to week, sometimes day to day bit of energy that I put into this, to sustain it. And I love it. I feel like if I've earned anything, being able to sort of manage my opportunities in bluegrass, it's having then the opportunity to say, okay, I have, you know, I know a few things about this, and I've worked on my own playing enough and gotten better and continue to want to get better. And one of the things that helps me do that is to help you do that. And sort of formulate a legitimate conversation about, okay, here's how you flat pick, and here's the mechanics, but here's also the music, and here's here's what we can call a quality and the target to try to hit. And you know, again, galvanize a real conversation about that and have some lessons around that. And so the Artist Works thing has been a really great opportunity for me, not just to have another gig, but just to really get inside what it is that I do and feel like I can articulate things about that in a way that other people can feel themselves improve.
For people who aren't aware, why don't you talk a little bit more about Artist Works, what it is and you know, what your role is.
You know, the elevator pitch is that Artist Works is
elevator pitch.
it's one of several options for folks these days to learn an instrument online. What separates Artist Works from all those other options is that you deal directly with somebody like me through this process called video exchange. And what that means is when you sign onto the site, you're going to see a huge amount of video content that are just the songs, the lessons, the exercises, chords and scales and whatnot, and all kinds of other goodies. But every student has the opportunity to film themselves working on whatever it is in that curriculum that they want to jump into. Or if they're new, just say, hey, I'm new. Here's me playing something. Tell me what to do. Anyway, the point is I review everything that comes in to me. I have this energetic queue of videos to review. And so what I do, my job is to sit with those videos, review, watch, look at what you did last time, basically formulate a response, and I film that response. And so the video exchange is you sending in a video, me responding to that video. What I love about the Artist Works sort of ethos is that it's a community-based thing, sort of like a virtual masterclass where everybody that's signed on sees everything. So it's not a private exchange between a student and myself. It's public. And so what I love about that is what I love about masterclass teaching is that a student and teacher are engaging, but yet you're doing this in front of a huge group of people that are also gaining something from that experience. And so that's what you have at Artist Works, is this sort of virtual masterclass way of learning and teaching, to where even though I'm talking to some specific person about where they're putting their pinky finger on the fiddle tune, I may be also speaking to 300 other people that are dealing with that same song on that same level. And so that's, you know, that's the value of that.
That's pretty smart that they make those videos available to everybody, because that also weeds out like minutia.
Yeah.
I'm sure you get some of it, but overall, if someone's not going to be petty and, you know.
Well, I mean, and again, to the credit of like the sort of masterclass style, the student that has put themselves forth, you know, yeah, they're engaging in some serious stuff that they may not have dealt with in their jam group or just sitting around playing along with records, which is like, I'm performing now. And we talk about that on the site a lot, performance space and practice space. And when you push play on that camera or record on that camera, and you know that I'm going to watch it and that a bunch of people are going to watch this, it suddenly, how much do you trust what you've worked on? And that is such a great thing to deal with. And I think a lot of amateurs don't do that. And they just haven't either had the opportunity, don't even know about the opportunity to put themselves into that sort of realm. So yeah, there's a serious sort of fortitude thing called into action. But again, what I love about it is that this is a community of people. There's all kinds of other ways that people interact. It's got this very sort of helpful vibe. You know that when you are submitting a video that it's, I'm not going to come down hard. I'm going to say what I need to say and get the points across, but it's, we're loving and we're helpful, and all I want to do is help you get better, and everybody else wants to see everybody else get better. So it's a fun time in that regard too. But yeah, I love the aspect of the performance pressure.
Yeah.
That's what's helped me get better, is work on things and then learn to trust that, either in a studio setting or live performance setting.
Hey, you grew up in Asheville. I know Asheville's probably changed dramatically since you were a kid. I was there a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you had overall a pretty healthy and a real fun childhood.
Yeah. I mean, it's nothing but blessing on that end of it. As far as, whether or not I'd ended up, would end up as a guitar player, professional musician or not, just I had a great family and great extended family. And the music thing was, the power of that was just knowing that there was extended community that was also supportive and provided lots of opportunity. I mean, in the summertime when I was in most of my formative years, I was playing three or four nights a week, my dad always had music going around the house, and we played guitars a lot together, and then various sort of family band entities. It was just a very, very consistent thing, music and positive versions of that. It wasn't like a stage parent and look at my talented kid and get up there and smile and wear, you know, rhinestones and things like this. It was a legit sort of traditional music community of just, you know, lots of jams, lots of multi-generational things going on. And that was what I had, and it's amazing. But as far as like what people look at Asheville as these days, a lot of that was already there. It was still there. The seeds of what is happening now was there. It's a little bit of a blue zone and a red region.
That was very politically correct,
if you will. Purple Asheville.
I hear you.
Always featured that, you know, and I think, you know, people from even back then, when there was a little less contentiousness, there was still sort of some balance of what you could hear. There was an NPR story done about Asheville years ago where people talked about the balance of Baptists and hippies.
The balance of Baptists and hippies. That's pretty funny.
Yes. Yeah.
You mentioned your dad several times. What kind of work did your dad do?
He and my mom were both teachers. Dad started his teaching career in in juvie, basically. He taught, I think, English in what was called the Juvenile Evaluation Center outside of Asheville in Swannanoa. And then mom taught public school all her career. And dad moved to the high school that I ended up going to after some years of teaching at juvie. And so they both are retired school teachers, essentially.
That's great. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have an older sister that's 3 years older, and she played fiddle when we were kids, and she was serious about it, but I think never quite had the fire for it that I did. What's cool is she has a daughter now that's playing fiddle, my niece Bailey, and I think gotten Lisa back into playing some and just being around it. And so that's cool. And Lisa's, even though she wasn't playing, like even when she came back to our area after some other, you know, career moves outside, she got involved in the sort of production side of music around Asheville. There's, you know, committees and the Folk Heritage Committee that puts on various events around town. And she got involved in that end of it too. So, you know, music has always been a big part of her scene.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Hey, we've talked about all the really cool things you've accomplished. Obviously, this happened and with a lot of work, and you're no different than everybody else. I'm sure you had some hurdles or obstacles to deal with. What were some of those, if you're open to sharing them, either personally, music-related, or business-related?
One of my bigger sort of personal obstacles has sort of dealt with, it's weird, you know, I see myself in these great situations, but I sometimes still feel like they could have gotten somebody else, you know, or I'm just here because Tony Rice is sick and I would much rather see Tony Rice too. And I'm sorry, it's me.
So you feel like a little undeserving at times?
Yeah, it's a little, part of it also, as I sort of sit and self-examine, you know, my particular place in the timeline of all this, I'm the young guy in the group of, you know, Ricky Skaggs, Jerry Douglas, Tony Rice, all the Hot Rise dudes. You know, I'm the young generation of that, but now I'm sort of the older guy in the generation of sort of Chris Thiele, you know, that, to use him to define everything that's younger than him that's really great that's happening right now.
Mm.
And so anyway, just as I sort of ponder stuff like that, it sort of feels like I don't have enough of my own sort of what I would call that platform, maybe. Even though I do, and ultimately I think if you're just a fan of bluegrass, you sort of see me in there as you see anybody else. But the way I feel about it, I either wish that I was a little more age wise connected to the older guys, or younger to connect with the younger dudes. And again,
don't worry. Not to cut you off, time will fix that.
yeah, I know. It is already.
In 10 years, you'd be like, man, I wish I was 10 years younger.
Yeah, it's certainly taking care of this. And some of this was a little more a little more sort of in the forefront of my radar 10 years ago, maybe. And I am a little more settled into my own space, especially after doing a little more solo work on, and that helped.
Yeah.
But anyway, but that's been part of the challenge and things to overcome. And I am overcoming it, of just finding my place in this and being okay with that as far as, you know, who I associate with. And ultimately the healthy side of it is, wow, I have this great opportunity to go play in the Telluride House Band with Bela and Sam and Jerry and Edgar Meyer and Stuart Duncan, but then also go hang out with, you know, this whole great crew of younger musicians that are, really exciting to be around and just hang out and not sort of feel like the old guy, even though I probably am.
I hear you, man.
And so anyway, that's been a little, to sum it up, it's a little bit of that. It's sort of dealing with my place and sometimes feeling like a little bit of the imposter. Just because here's the bottom line is that it's like when I'm on stage with Hot Rise or when I'm on stage with those guys at Telluride, those dudes worked their tail off from the late 70s to be able to earn that spot of selling out rooms, of closing down the festival. And here I come in, you know, 15, 20 years ago and then sort of swoop in because, you know, either somebody died or somebody's sick or whatever. And I'm fortunate to be that guy that got that call, but I didn't do that initial work like in the Hot Rod scene to be able to go sell out rooms. You know, that Charles Sautel was the original guy in the band that helped the band get to that level of stature and legendary sort of place. And I'm fortunate to sort of drink from that Kool-Aid.
Sure. I think sometimes we feel, because I've gone through something like that in earlier, and I think sometimes we have this thing like that suffering and success that, you know, you need to suffer. There's a certain amount of suffering you do. But because I've studied a lot of this and I came to the conclusion that suffering is mutually exclusive from being successful. You know, it's not like a prereq. It's not like you got to take suffering 101 and then move to 102 before you can get, you know, success 102, you know, it's right. Kind of mutually exclusive. Sometimes you have to, sometimes you don't, but I don't think they're related, but I do understand those. I have felt undeserving at times in certain things in my life as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's what I would, not to counter you, but in the session world and in bluegrass, just like in jazz, you do sort of have to earn your spot. You have to prove yourself a little bit to yourself and to people that are, you're playing with or people that are hiring you. And some of that's just paying dues. And that's another thing as far as sort of feeling somewhat imposter-ish is, again, like my first real bluegrass gig outside of playing with my family as a kid was with Ricky Dang Skaggs. And here I am, you know, in front of 5,000 people at Wolf Trap on my first professional weekend, or 10,000 people in my hometown. And I see all these other bluegrass musicians, you know, struggling to make a few $100 a week at stringing these festivals together in the summer, equally as talented, but I guess, you know, I've just been afforded all this opportunity, and it's a little weird. And I have paid dues, but it's just been a different kind of due, I guess.
No, I mean, it's just serendipity, man. Sometimes shit happens. It's good, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, great. So say thank you. I'm happy, you know?
Yeah. And I know that I've worked hard. And that's the other thing. I don't feel like that I just sort of sat around and all these things started coming my way. And I know if I am also proud of something, I feel like that even in the midst of a lot of that good stuff happening, either on stage with bluegrass or in studios, I've really worked and feel it pay off continue to be challenged as far as just me as a guitar player. At the end of the day, it just comes down to me and how I feel I am as a guitar player. And I know I could be better, but I know that I've also worked to be better. And I do feel that pay off. And I like the idea that even in the midst of being a pro and, you know, enjoying all this great sort of high profile stuff, you know, there's still enough reason for me to just get the guitar out and work on stuff and try and be better and just keep pushing.
I heard this reminds me of, I interviewed somebody, I don't remember who, maybe just a while ago, but they said a joke about the top 10 guitar players in the world all get in a room and every one of them is worried about what the other nine guys are going to do.
Yeah.
All the top guys I talk to, and I think this is in any profession, you always want to be better. It's the
I want to be better. Yeah. And that's where my career is now, to sort of pick up on that, as far as doing the teaching and doing more solo stuff. I have done a lot of things that I've set out to do. I've reached a lot of goals, and that's the one thing that I can always come back to, even after all that is realized. It's like, yeah, but I can still be a better guitar player.
Everybody can, no matter what we're doing, you know.
Yeah.
Better marketer, better accountant, whatever it is you do. Yeah. So looking back, if you had to go and give your younger Brian Sutton advice, what advice would you have given yourself had you been open to accepting it?
I would say to continue working on just relax, getting in my own way is something that I'm really, really good at. And either physically in the real time of playing, or forcing things, relax, chill out.
Yeah, I hear you.
I'm intense sometimes, and in that regard, and I don't need to be.
Well, you know, intensity is a blessing and a curse, as you know. You know.
Yeah, I've again, since I was a teenager, sort of had this fire to, you know, I'm going to make a living playing music. I'm going to do this. There's no plan B. I'm just, you know, my head is down. And that's pretty intense. And, you know, I would tell myself at that point, yeah, but just, you know, try to enjoy this a little bit more.
Yeah.
And also, there was earlier on, I would get way, way down for a bad show. If I had a bad solo, it was just, you know, it was stupid. I would get overwrought about mistakes and things like that. And, you know, chill out, dude.
Yeah, enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to guitar? I'm pretty sure you got a signature custom, and you know what other guitars might round out your top three or four.
Well, you know, for bluegrass playing, the holy grail thing is the Martin D28 from about 1935 to early 1939, to be very, very specific. And I was fortunate to find a 36 D28 about a year and a half ago that has been my main axe since then. But it's tricky because, you know, about every year and a half or 2 years, especially the last 10 years, I've kind of had a different main guitar for that kind of playing. What I feel like is me at my most true core, in front of people playing stream of consciousness bluegrass. It's on a D28 of some sort. But this 36 D28 has come along, and it's made me want to be more of a committed relationship guy.
Brian, you know, I just want to tell you, as soon as he started talking about this guitar, his this big smile lit. Since you've been talking about this, your whole, like, you can just tell you're in, like, love.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the guitar, to be honest. It had a new bridge plate and a new bridge and a new neck set when I got it. And for anybody that's familiar with those old things, anytime you do stuff like that, it sort of, you know, it shakes it up a little bit. And so it was a little bit kind of closed sounding when I got it. And part of the fun of having this thing is the more I've beat on it over the last year and a half, it's really opened up and turned into, you know, more of what I feel like is a real manifestation of itself now and what it's going to be. And so it's paying off. But anyway, so that 36D28 right now I'm really focusing on as my axe. That's my guitar. There have been versions of that over the years, but anyway, that's I really hope to put some effort into that. As far as like other things, as a session player, you know, we all have sort of the toolbox. And so to get into that conversation, any session I go to, I take that D28, but I also take, I have a 1949 Gibson Southern Jumbo that usually goes everywhere, a couple of small bodies like a 35 single 018s, an LG2. I've been a complete sucker on reverb.com for the last 6 or 8 months and found these really, really funky, cool 30s, 40s small body things like harmonies and Epiphone things. And
Harmony makes acoustics.
Yes.
I didn't know. I love those old harmonies like from the 50s, the electric ones, man.
Yeah. Well, and this is during the 40s, there's these, you know, they made these really cool models called the Vogue V and the Vagabond, and, you know, guitars. I'm a sucker for a guitar that has a decal on it. And a lot of these things are, you know, they're birch guitars or maple guitars with ladder bracing. And sometimes you can take these, one of the harmonies that I got, a guy had done a really great job of taking the top off and making it an X brace guitar. And the yield from that is really wonderful. It's basically you have kind of like a 0018 Martin size and sound and significantly less price. Just a great feeling guitar, and they're funky, and they all, what I'm a fan of, especially these days, is acoustic guitars that have very specific voices. I've always loved playing like resonator guitars. And I've got a few of those that always go to sessions with me. But, you know, yeah, so just very distinct voices on acoustic guitar, you know. So there's always, there's the gut string, the high strings, the 12 strings, all that, you know. I have the full toolbox there of a session dude.
Who does your work in town on your guitars? Is Joe? I don't know.
Joe Blazer has done a lot of consistent stuff for me over the years. I like Joe for, you know, when I need a guitar to play perfectly in tune, not just exactly, but perfectly everywhere. He has the whole Plex system, and I can pretty much trust that he's going to work to get it right. There are other fellas in my zone of a bluegrass player that they're players themselves, and there's just something about when one bluegrass player that's able to do a guitar setup is doing a setup for another bluegrass guitar player. There's just some inherent stuff that's going on that's maybe different than your standard, this guitar is set up easy to play up and down the neck. You know, bluegrassers need a little stiffer action, a little higher action, but also not too much. And it just seems like, so anyway, I have some folks around Nashville and elsewhere that are like, when I really want this thing to be set up for bluegrass, I go for that.
Are there any cool stories behind how you acquired any of these guitars?
Probably not.
No, it's all good.
I've just made purchases and tried to trade up over the years with various things.
Who, anybody influence your playing that people would be surprised to hear?
Eddie Van Halen.
Wow, that is surprising.
Yeah, strong hands. Eddie Van Halen has great strong hands. Eric Johnson, same way. I spent a lot of years from 12, 13 to 17, 18, really digging into a lot of rock players. I sort of grew him out and watch his lessons, but Paul Gilbert is also one of the guys on ArtistWorks. And I went to see him do a clinic in Asheville when I was a teenager, and I was way into Ibanez guitars, Steve Vai, the whole thing. And so, yep, those sort of late 80s shredders, if you will, I'm a fan of. I mean, I never got into like Yngwie that much, but Eddie Van Halen seemed to be, he was sort of Tony Rice's, where what you get with a player like that is this sort of really strong but immaculate and graceful technique, very toneful, very musical, very strong. That's the lesson I get from Eddie Van Halen, and just great soloing ideas.
Yeah, that's for sure, man. So literally several thousand guitar players are going to be listening to this. So one thing I think a lot of them would want to know is, what are some basic exercises, you know, that you could recommend to get their speed up? Because when I look at you playing, you know, and I'm not like a fanboy or blowing smoke, your playing is like way beyond great. It's like you're from another planet. And I look at that because, you know, I listen to blues and rock, and you'll have a guy take a Van Halen, a 1 minute solo. That's a long solo. You're doing in bluegrass, you're on fire like 3-4 minutes, and it's like, you know, nonstop. And it's funny because I've watched a lot of videos of you, your body language. And when you're done, it's almost like you just got off the roller coaster. I could see your body like,
yeah,
because of the amount of energy you've got to put into that is phenomenal to play at a clip like that. So do you have any, like, you know, 1 minute cliff note advice for guy, I know that doesn't exist, but like, what is like a smart thing you'd advise people listening to that are, you know, to play with that kind of accuracy and speed, or what exercises?
Well, I would start the conversation with recognizing that it is everything you said it is. It's physical, it's athletic. It involves strength, endurance, and stamina, because it's one thing to kind of get there, but it's another thing to keep it there.
Yeah.
You know, any athlete would tell you that. And so to kind of run through some things quickly that I know that helped me and continue to help me is time that I spent studying classical guitar. I equate that to a football player that takes ballet to learn how to move better.
Hmm.
When I got deeper inside fretting hand, fretting arm technique, for efficiency's sake, that was huge and continues to be huge. As far as the picking side, yes, I mean, to get into some of the way that I try to teach this stuff, you start relatively slow, but not too slow. I have this term of being musical and manageable. You know, I think we want people to slow down, but we don't want to lose touch with the music that is bluegrass. And bluegrass, not every song in bluegrass is fast, but a lot of it is, and you need that skill. So anyway, being relevant, but also knowing that, or relevant tempo-wise, but having quality really as the target. Speed is not the target. The target is speed with musicality and tonefulness. And so the deal is that, however I can settle and feel as musical as I need to be at those tempos, that's when I know that I'm hitting it out of the park is when I am more settled. So you can practice being settled, and then in my advice, there's, you know, sort of different good ways to get there, either just through stair-stepping your way up through tempos. But it's attainable through that. But I think, again, focusing on what quality is, what tone is, the other part of the hard side and the athletic side is we're playing acoustically. You know, I want to know that I can do this in a room with people playing an acoustic guitar. It's not, I don't have the ability to turn an amp up. You know, I'm on stage and I can get closer and farther away from the mic, or plug in and turn myself up. But I want to know that it's within me completely. So it's all about me and my technique and refining that. And again, that gets back to the establishing the thing, but also sustaining the thing, learning to relax and get relaxed and stay settled. That's all. A lot of times what you trust or don't trust, when you do get to a certain level of, okay, I can play pretty quick, but then I fall apart. A lot of times people are not trusting, or I deal with a lot of people on my site that are pretty good intermediate players, but they struggle with the ceiling on the tempo. And I'll see a video of them playing and they're actually playing faster than they need to. And that's all tension. So managing tension, to sum it up, is a huge deal.
Yeah.
And the other thing that, especially playing bluegrass, is that, and as again, any athlete would tell you, it's first, again, this recognition of what's going on fundamentally, but then just playing a lot, doing the work. What I had as a kid that I didn't know I had was just a work ethic that was just fun.
Yeah.
I was getting out all the time and playing music. And I read interviews with athletes, especially like pro golfers, that said, I just would just go out in the range and hit for 5 hours a day in the summertime because I didn't have anything else to do. And that was that way. We just spent hours at festivals or hours in jam sessions or hours with my dad just playing all the time. And that really developed this sort of sense of natural habit about it. And I had to tweak that later and make that refine and get it better and focus it and challenge it. But especially in bluegrass, one of my most strongest bits of advice is to find people to play with and just do it as much as you can. Because, again, to your point, the last thing I'll say is it's not just about your spot to jump out there and take a solo, but you're providing rhythm. You know, you got to go play a guitar solo, then you got to run back and play drums for the rest of the song.
Yeah.
And it's not about just, you know, like an electric guitar where you can just sustain and let some two note kind of copy thing take over. You know, you're a big part of the engine of that song as a rhythm guitarist, and to not focus on that just as much as you're focusing on solos is doing half the battle. So jamming a lot gets you an opportunity to do that, playing, because again, you're only playing your one solo, but you're going to be playing 3 or 4 minutes of rhythm.
Hmm. Man, thank you. I really appreciate that. If I was a bluegrass player, well, first of all, if anybody, I would say go to, again, I mentioned this earlier, go to YouTube and look at Brian on this song called Logjam. That is like, I didn't even know what to say or think after I saw that. And then, man, sign up at Artistworks. And that was not a setup for Brian, but I'm thinking, man, if I was a bluegrass player, I'd be on there. I mean, what the? Anyway, how is your playing? I know you're like a type A, you're a driven guy. How would you say your playing has changed over the last 5 years? Because I know you're always growing and pushing.
Yeah. One of the things that's challenging for a bluegrass guitarist, and me very much included, is sort of managing on the improv side. Meaning, because we're playing pretty strong, I try not to play too hard, but I do sometimes. But we're digging in other
words.
And we're playing, you know, lickety-split tempos, and we got to be heard and all this kind of stuff. And so what that yields a lot of times is very guitaristic, just phrases, just things that kind of fall out of us. And I don't deny that. I don't say I don't poo-poo that. I don't want to avoid that completely, because some of that's a vocabulary that I can rely on when I need it.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, I also recognize it for what it is, as a little bit of a safety net. And so I feel like moves that I have made in the last 5 years, maybe even plus a few, are more solid improvisational types of processing in real time at those tempos, at those volume levels, that feel also in the moment and responsive and fun and that kind of thing. So that, you know, how I become a better improviser, or try to become a better improviser, that's been a big focus of late, of that time period. Hanging around Julian Lodge has been a really good thing for me. One of my little things that I do is sort of sum up guitar players that I'm a fan of in kind of one or two words. And for Julian, it's possibility. I mean, I never hear or talk to him where it's just, I'm not inspired to just do whatever.
Yeah.
there are no rules, but it's also still very strong, very melodic, and very, very purposeful in itself. And I want my playing to, I'd like to feel what he must feel when he's taking a solo.
Yeah. Well, that's a very difficult thing, man, to manage improv at that breakneck speed. It's not like you're a rock guitarist where you can slow it up and still, you know, like you said, you got to sustain, you got a wow, you got something. You could just slow up the tempo, even if it's a fast song. It's really different. That's a very challenging thing, man.
Yeah, but again, it's also a choice. I mean, and a lot of us on the guitaristic side, and again, it's part of it, but to just rip off eighths or sixteenths, however you want to look at it, you know, from note one to the last thing, that is part of what we do in bluegrass. Hmm. But I also like that idea, again, in this sort of spirit of what's possible to play some double stops, or to play some chords, or to do some bends, and you know, just think about what the phrase could be. And again, because it is fast, it's an added sort of bit of, okay, I really don't have time to take much of a breath here. And I'm sort of like a fighter pilot right now in combat
mode. Yeah, man.
And I'm just doing nothing but reacting. But again, part of what you work on is learning to settle in the face of all that intense, you know, quick chaos. And it's fun, you know. And the other good thing about having fiddle tunes as a basis for a lot of what we do in bluegrass is that there's always this melody that you can play too.
Yeah,
you don't
yeah.
have to just sort of blow over the changes and using the melody, using the phrasing, using the breath that happens because you stop. Those are all good habits to get into.
Desert Island Discs, if I asked you to pick your top three in no particular order, knowing this can change tomorrow, what would be your knee-jerk reaction just for now?
Oh, or records that aren't mine?
You can pick yours, man. God bless you. I like that. You're funny, man. You're like super intense, and you come out with these like really like funny things. They're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, the guys that travel with me get tired of my little stupid puns.
No, I like the best one was when you said, thank you for reading this. I like, you know, it's hard to hear that more than every other day. That was good. I wasn't expecting that. That was good.
Desert Island Disc. I think the bottom line one for me is Tony Rice's Manzanita record, of which I think it came out 40 years ago this year. Maybe wow. Maybe in this month, summer of 78, I think. So yeah, Tony Rice's Manzanita record is huge for most of us that play modern bluegrass. Doc Watson's Southbound record to me really makes me feel like I'm sitting right there with him. It's just two acoustics and bass. Sometimes it's just him and a bass player, but I love the breadth of the material on that record and just the way it's recorded. It's just warm. And again, it feels like you're just sitting at his feet. Gosh, a third one, man, I don't know. I think it would be the disc that I make from collecting MP3s of thousands of other records.
And fair enough, man.
I don't know. That's a hard one. The other one, you know what I do, my musical sort of clear the air sorbet thing is solo classical piano. And I've got some recordings of this guy named Eric Lesage. And I really love that. I love listening to solo classical piano, and whether it be some Schumann stuff or whatever, that I would probably choose that.
Is that what you listen to like in the car when you need to decompress?
Yes.
Cool. All righty. So tough question, man. What do you like most about yourself?
What I like most about myself? That's weird.
it is a tough question, man. It is a weird question.
I like that I'm continually trying to refine. I think that I like that I'm making choices to not be settled, even though I've had a lot of great opportunities. And like I said earlier, I have reached a lot of goals, and I don't want to call it a struggle right now, but I am trying to sort of ponder about what the next thing or things might be. And I'm proud that I'm not saying, okay, I just want to stop and go play golf.
Sure.
I want to do some of that. I like the idea of just not hustling so much sometimes, but I really want to keep pursuing a better version of me. And also seeing other areas where, because of what I've done, it's not just necessarily another show or another record, but like with the teaching thing or a thing that I feel good about doing is mentoring young players, young bands that might be producing. But I like that I'm realizing more of that about myself. I like that. Through my wife's help, I think I've done a pretty decent job of being a professional musician and a dad and husband. Balance has always been a big focus for me, just the concept of balance.
It's very tough.
In the music career, I've balanced stage and studio and all this various stuff, generally having, you know, a very frenetic kind of routine, but within that, you know, really, again, sometimes I miss hugely, but in general, I feel like my kids feel like they have a dad and not just some guy that comes in the house every now and again. and so I feel pretty good about that. I don't want to sit down and just, you know, surround myself with gold leafing in that regard, but I'm proud of what I've done in that balance of career and life, home.
What do you think you're so driven? Like, where does that come from? If that's even answerable.
For me, it's been, I see things, this is an opportunity, and it's not like, wow, these people finally figured out how good I am and now they're calling me. This feel like, again, part of the humble side of what I said earlier about being somewhat imposterish. The positive side of that is like, wow, I have this is a real opportunity to be able to do this. And if I turn it down, you know, I'm going to miss it. Mm. And so I'm driven to not miss things, whether it be personal or professional.
Sure.
And I think one of the things that I did realize, and this is part of what I try to mentor with younger musicians, whatnot, is that your skill might be valuable, and your, whatever you can bring to a project, stage, studio might be valuable, but your time is what's ultimately valuable. That's what I had to realize from balancing studio stuff and stage things and having to make decisions to turn this session down to go play the show or to turn it all down to go to Disney World with family or whatever. It's like, my ultimate value is my time and who needs that most, and set up priorities for who needs that most. And so I can't remember how I actually got here in this discussion, but
I was asking you what how did you get so driven?
Oh yeah, right. So it's just, I think with drive comes perspective then, and realizing that when an opportunity is there, you better lunge on it, you know. And my wife thankfully has been on that, in that team as well, of sort of recognizing when opportunities are there, that maybe it's counter to a plan that we had earlier. But, and again, it's not an excuse to just go take every dollar that is coming my way, but realize that within the big picture of it all, you know, it's, these are all great opportunities, and you keep this, wow, look what I'm able to do kind of attitude about it all. And that just, I don't know, just keeps it all kind of fun and you know, it doesn't feel like work.
Yeah, man, so. You can make more money. You can't make more time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say your best childhood memory is?
I had a great house, a very supportive family, but when I think back, music, like through the music filter, we used to play this festival over in Union Grove, North Carolina, and the festival was called Fiddler's Grove. And I remember going to sleep at night, listening to people around the campground play music, and waking up the next morning and either those same people playing music or somebody else playing music.
Oh, wow.
And just remembering, just having this moment of like, wow, that is so cool. The fact that there is this thing and it's bringing these people together and it's just nonstop music. And that's, you know, sort of in that sort of Telluride answer I gave earlier, it's just sort of a sum up of a lot of versions of that, of just how music was such a fun thing, and always something that I wanted to do and having great opportunities. But that, I remember that particular, or moments like that at that festival, just stick with me. I remember I was 16, the very first bluegrass festival I went to, which it's always fun to think about because Tony Rice was there and Jerry Douglas was there and Hot Rise was there. And I'm sitting out, you know, recording their shows on my little handheld tape cassette thing. And, you know, that was impactful. It was one of those moments that said, for me, you know, I want to be part of this.
That's really nice. Something or someone you miss from your childhood, Brian?
My grandfather was a fiddler, Grover Sutton. And there are things that I've done that he would have gotten a gas of seeing me on stage, like at the Grand Ole Opry and various things like that. Hmm. He would have dug that, I think. He was a really talented fiddler, kind of a tinkerer, and, you know, a good figure in our music community, and liked by a lot of people. And he was a good dude, and we had a lot of good times playing fiddles together when I was a kid. And it would have been fun to see him see me do some of the things that I've done. I think, yeah.
Thanks. Tell me something about yourself that people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Well, I think maybe you would be surprised to hear that I'm currently on, I don't know how, what level, I don't think it's level. It's just, I'm pretty far into this game, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Video game. What is that? On what platform?
Nintendo Switch.
That is so funny. You're into Legend of Zelda. I remember my kids playing that when they were kids. Legend of, they said, hey, let's play Zelda. I'm like, what is that? What do you mean? That's so funny.
My youngest daughter, Lily, who's 13, got into it earlier this year. And sort of like with our whole experience with Legos, I would sort of sit with her and either sometimes do some of the little things, like the little, just like being a sous chef. She would do all the hard stuff and I would just sort of get, you know, get more weapons or more whatever. But anyway, I started my own little quest thing about a month ago or so. just because I got sucked into this thing, and it's fun. It's a good way to kind of blow about half an hour when you're waiting for people to come downstairs to go somewhere.
Yeah, man.
So that might be somewhat surprising, I guess, or weird.
You know what, though? My sons are 28 and 26, and they still talk about Once in a Blue Moon. I was not a big video gamer, but we played like Tomb Raider and what was that other one with all the characters? Mortal Kombat. And once in a while, we'll pass something or we'll conversation and say, yeah, Dad, remember when we did this in Tomb Raider? And it's like kind of funny that because I'm not that guy, and it was just like a one-off thing, you know, to hang out with them, really, like you're talking about hanging out with Lily. So she'll come back and remember this, Dad, which is nice.
Yeah.
You mentioned your wife a few times. How long y'all been together?
We were married in 1996, so they were going on year 22 now.
Good, man. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
That's a major accomplishment.
It is.
It really is. Man, that's tough. Good for you, man. Besides golf, any hobbies or interests outside of music?
You know what? This might go into the other question, too. I am a bit of a self-appointed AV nerd around my house and not just like hooking up the Wi-Fi and the TVs and stuff and the Apple TVs, but I have, it's not up right now, but over the last 4 or 5 seasons, I call it, I've constructed and watched movies on this 9x16 foot screen in the driveway. And, and it's like over the top home movie kind of stuff. But the great thing about it is that I put this whole little cart together with the projector and an amp, and I can plug some speakers into it and basically create this little driveway scene with this huge screen. 9x16 is a little bit bigger than like a 2-car garage door.
Yeah.
It sits about 4.5 or so feet high off the ground in this structure. And this is a whole kit thing about the internet. But anyway, I really, you know, I dove into this whole world of home movie craft and just the read all the forums and all the ideas about all the DIY stuff. And anyway, then I went whole hog into this whole rig. And but what's the two most fun things about it? Well, three is the first one is that we've had like these sort of multifamily movie nights in the driveway where we'll, you know, show something, get some food. Also, at Lily's school one year, set the whole rig up on the blacktop outside the school, and they had this sort of reward program for these kids that had done a certain amount of work.
Oh, that's cool.
And I showed a movie to all these kids and their families, and they had a little games, and that was, you know, that was the entertainment. And then, and sort of the one of the more fun highlights of having that rig at the house was when the Cubs won the World Series, what was that, 2 seasons ago? And it just worked. It was a beautiful night in Nashville. And a lot of people were in town. And so I just put some calls together that day. And we had, you know, a driveway full of people, got a bunch of barbecue, and people brought food and parked in the yard. And they had this basically kind of jam session / viewing party of Game 7, watching the Cubs win the World Series.
Dude, that is cool.
And we had, you know, fire pit and lawn chairs. And you know, there was a rain delay toward the end of the game. And we pulled out the instruments and started playing music. And it was just really neat thing.
Very cool. Party at Sutton's this weekend.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, I put it up a couple weeks ago, and we had this new pool area, and it didn't like that zone, and the wind took it right over. So I gotta rethink some of this.
Go back to what works, man.
Yeah,
driveway.
Proven.
So, hobbies or interests outside of music, besides golf?
You know what? Probably not. There's not a lot of time.
Yeah, I know. Between all the stuff you got going on, I would have been surprised if you came up with a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I do feel like a lot of my minutes in my day are taken up. And it's not that I am one of these sort of workaholics or can't sit still-aholics. But, yeah, I mean, I have a lot going on. I think, you know, usually what I feel like at any given time, I've got about 3 jobs between the teaching and studio stuff or production now and touring things like right now. To rehearsal after this and flying out later this week.
To Telluride? So,
yeah. Well, got 2 gigs with Hot Rise this weekend and Telluride's next weekend.
Where's your gigs this weekend?
We're with Hot Rise up around New York City, Port Washington, New York, and then this place called Clearwater, which is like a Pete Seeger Festival or something like that.
Oh, cool. Port Washington's Long Island, I think, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Hey, 2 more questions, man, and I really appreciate this. I've enjoyed this, and I appreciate your time, man. You've been great. best advice you've ever been given and who gave it to you?
There was this guy, and again, fortunate to have met him on the very first session that I ever just hung out and watched in Asheville, this guy named David Johnson, who just a consummate professional studio player, classic example of a dude that nobody will ever hear of, but anybody that's ever met him will never forget him. He's a multi-instrumentalist and not one of these jack of all trades, master of none kind of guys. He's believable and impactful on anything that he does on a record. And I'm not saying that because he's a pal. It really is that way. And I recognize that from day one anyway. And just talking to him early in my days as a session player and going like, you know, why would they call me when they can't call you? And he told me, he says, you know, you're in that chair and it's your chair and you are there. And so it was a call to say, here's the moment and you recognize the moment. And what are you doing now in this moment to either get in your own way, which is what I was doing of wondering, you know, letting this whole psychology thing kind of get in my way. Or are you listening to the song? Are you paying attention? Are you enjoying yourself? Are you feel like you're, kind of owning it basically. And that was part of his advice way early on that I never quite have forgotten. And I would also couple that from him. Just there's rarely a session goes by for me that I don't think about him in some regard, just his attitude and his disposition, whether the song's going on or just hanging around the coffee maker. Just his whole being has been one big kind of collection of little bits of advice after the other. But that was the main thing of just, yes, you're a session player. And yes, especially after I moved to Nashville, there's, you know, 45 other guitar players that could be on this gig, but you're here and you're, and what can you do to own this? And, other things like another, again, fortunate to meet him early on, this bass player named Tim Smith, growing up playing bluegrass, you know, click tracks are like this foreign thing, metronomes. And so that was one of my early struggles. And it's a sort of small compared to like what I, in this big, this, you know, conversation here, as far as like what I'm getting from David Johnson. But Tim said, when you can make that metronome feel like a member of the band, I've heard different versions of that, as far as how people interpret playing along with a metronome. But as a session player, that is one of the most key, that's sort of like that's your playing field, is your tempo, along with the songs and the structure and the vibes and all this kind of stuff in the parts. But what are you doing to make this song feel good at this tempo? And that's your job. And, you know, I've struggled with various versions of that over the years with various parts. But that bit of advice of what can you do to allow this metronome to feel like a member of the band, make it musical, you know, make your part as musical where you don't sound like a robot or sound metronomic or even sound like those little redirects in your timing as you're playing a rolling finger style part, you know? So, and that's rhythm just in general has been one of the things that I really like to think a lot about and how I can create a more honest, consistent relationship with rhythm. But anyway, Tim's advice about playing with a metronome, playing with a click track all those years ago, again, it's just stuff that I think about every day.
That's really good advice, both of those guys. So David was basically saying, hey man, you're here. It's up to you to make the best of it. Mm-hmm. One way or another, it's your choice. And then make the metronome. Those are great pieces of advice. Last question, Brian, is what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of this change has been deliberate and intentional, and how much has just been a natural part of aging?
I think I have gotten more comfortable in my own skin over the years. I guess that equates to some confidence that probably wasn't there years ago. I'm still a pretty quiet guy. I'm not the life of the party dude or, you know, sort of there's usually on a session, there's kind of a, just the kind of lead dog energy wise. Mm-hmm. And it's usually not me. Sometimes it is, but most of the time it's not me, but that happens. You know, I feel myself more comfortable around people, than I have. I feel better now than I used to, is what I'm trying to say. I do have a sense of myself as far as my career goes of, again, I'm not out to pasture, like I said, but I am, I've earned this kind of longevity thing that, not that I feel like, okay, I've got all this information that I have to go impart to younger players, but I do feel this sort of somewhat compelling feeling to share with people what I know. 'Cause I know people gave it to me.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's paying it forward. It's great.
Yeah, I guess so. But I love doing it. It's one of those things, again, as I've just felt opportunities come my way because I love it. This feels like an opportunity. It feels like, whether it's working with young, great, you know, college-age musicians or producing a band or teaching on artist works, I really enjoyed talking about it. I'm a geek enough about it all, and I've had these deep discussions about guitar and whatever with Julian Lodge and Chris Eldridge and Courtney Hartman and all these people and Grant Gordy over the years. And it's fun to have that conversation. I mean, I do this workshop at a camp that I've taught at regularly over the years, where we just get inside bluegrass rhythm guitar. It's like the most nerdy little thing. A bunch of us under a tent, and it's my iPod and a speaker, and we just listen to the evolution of bluegrass rhythm guitars from the 1920s to now. But I love that. I love getting into that and sharing my thoughts and just sharing what I feel is important with people.
Well, just so you know, I've talked to a couple of other people. One of them comes to mind is Rebecca Frazier, and she was effusive in how helpful you've been to her. So that's probably stuff you don't know about, or, you know, you may not, but you've made a big difference in her life as far as just helping her as a musician, as a human being, and as a player. And I'm sure if I went, you know, I'm speaking to Grant sometime, I'm sure I could ask him the same thing and I'll get the same answer. So whatever you're doing, people are feeling it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it comes from, again, having a community as a kid. I had nothing but support. Even as a session player, as a pro, I have felt supported and encouraged by my peers. And again, it feels like it's the natural thing. I think it's part of our ultimate job, and that's part of being a dad too, is to recognize what you can do to make yourself better is also what you're doing to help somebody else make themselves better.
For sure, man. Listen, I want to, first of all, I cannot thank you enough for your time. I've really enjoyed this. I've been looking forward to this while. You're an amazing player. I'm not a bluegrass guy. I'm not going to pretend to be, but I love your playing. And I, you know,
that's a great compliment. People at the end of shows sometimes, and they'll go, I don't like bluegrass, but I like what you do.
Well, I don't dislike it. I'm just not, it's not something, you know, I'm familiar with. I didn't grow up with it. It's just, it's almost like a foreign language to me. It's a musical foreign language to me, you know, but I'm fully aware of it. And when I watch you play, I'm in awe of what you do because I don't see many people that can do that. And just mechanically, I'm very aware of how much effort and how many moving parts are going on at once. And that's what really amazes me. And that's why I was watching your energy level because I'm like, how the hell is this guy handling? There's a lot of stuff going on there, man.
Yeah.
And that's why when I saw you physically, I'm like, man, that makes total sense because this guy just like, this is like round one of a boxing match. He needs to take a breather before he gets to round two, which is the second song. So, I mean, I'm really in awe of what you do musically and melodically and how you put it all together.
Thank you. I think bluegrass, to try to sum up for other people listening to this that aren't as aware of bluegrass, there are things that a lot of people don't like about it. And there's things that I don't like about it as far as some of the old and current stuff and the way people use bluegrass. But one of the things that it has offered for the last 40 years is this sort of breeding ground for people that want to improvise, that aren't really jazz players. It's had nothing but open doors for jazz players to come in and kind of get into these fiddle tunes and these, in this sort of structure like this. It's been a great breeding ground for modern, great classical technicians to come in and learn to improvise. We call it sort of the big tent in bluegrass, and it's tricky because there is some very small minds involved in sort of keeping things way small and traditional. And I've always been a fan of the people that interpret bluegrass a little more as a genre that is more inclusive And so anyway, the point is if people want to get into it, I would, you know, I would encourage a lot of listening. My friend Tim O'Brien says of old time music, and you could say it about bluegrass. Bluegrass is better than it sounds a lot of times.
No, when you're playing, I didn't feel any of that like pigeonhole stuff. It was a very open. That's why I enjoy. It was not like, you know, I had to sit like some guys when I interview them. I'm just not into that music at all. Yeah. I didn't feel like that when I was listening to your stuff. It was very open. I was just, you know, the melodies were great. I couldn't believe what all the stuff going on there. Again, you know, I'm not going to call myself as a musician, but
yeah,
as,
right.
you know, as a guy that's really into music and into guitar, I was fully aware of it, and it sounded great.
Yeah, that was the lesson, ultimate lesson from Doc Watson and Tony Rice and Norman Blake, Clarence White. It's, you know, and anybody that followed any of those players' recordings from here, that's what you'll hear as well. It's just like, well, this is good playing. It's technical. It's quick and fast, but toneful and musical and impactful and soulful.
Thank you, man. Everybody, I want to tell you what some stuff Brian's got upcoming. First of all, it's Brian Sutton, Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N. Please check him out. Support his music. Go to his website. He's got a great website, briansutton.com. Tells you when he's touring, all the cool stuff he's got going on. There's links there to Artist Works. If you are a guitarist and you want to enter the bluegrass world and you want to learn from, like, you know, admit, obviously one of the best people out there playing bluegrass that's doing this, man, go to artistworks.com. You couldn't afford to pay him one-on-one to do what he gives you on Artist Works. Brian's band Hot Rise is touring got a new album coming out in mid-July. You want to talk about the album a little bit?
Yeah. Well, Hot Rise has been around bluegrass for a lot of years. They started in 1978. So this is the 40th anniversary of the band. And so this record that we have is a live recording from Boulder Theater back in January, where we had Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Stuart Duncan join us on stage. And so the record is sort of the result of that party. And it's like, it's a big one. It's like 19, 20 songs or something like that. And it's some new songs and some old Hot Rise favorites. Hot Rise is what I call it. It's sort of like the Bluegrass Eagles, where every show is kind of like a reunion, and they're all about songs, and people love the material from way back. So anyway, this is the band's 40th anniversary. Hoorah.
That's awesome. And the album's coming out in mid-July, and you can, Brian will have that on his, webpage. Again, it's briansutton.com, and you're touring in the fall. Where are y'all touring?
Pieces are still coming together, but it'll be, I think there, it looks like, I was looking at it the other day, some Midwest, some Northeast stuff. I don't even remember.
Coming down here? Nobody ever comes to Florida. You coming here?
Tampa is not what I would call a huge bluegrass destination.
Apparently, it's not a bluegrass or a jazz or a rock or anything destination. No one comes here, man. It's like few and far between.
There is a great festival over in Live Oak annually.
Oh, yeah.
In the spring and fall. Anyway, yeah, I don't know of any Florida landings at this point. But again, there's some pieces there. I think it's coming together for real as of right now, in the next month or so.
Awesome. Well, go to briansutton.com. Again, it's B-R-Y-A-N, and check out Brian on the road and support him and Hot Rise, and wonderful player, super cool guy, as you heard. Man, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Again, thanks to Brian Sutton for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. Go support Brian online and listen to his music and buy it and enjoy it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com, sign up to get on our newsletter, and remember, most important, happiness is a choice, man. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.